This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. On the program today, we're going on a guided tour of the human brain. Our guides are neuroscientists Sam Wong and Sandra Amott. They are the co-authors of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive, and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. Did you know that a lot of things we think we know about our brains are wrong? Here's an example. How much of the brain do we use? 10%, right? Wrong. The answer is 100%. Here's another example. It's a multiple choice question. Which activities kill brain cells? A, drinking 3 bottles of beer in an evening. B, smoking a joint. C, dropping acid. D, all of the above. E, none of the above. The answer? E, none of the above. Listeners, I invite your phone calls about the brain for our guests this afternoon. We look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. Let me tell you a little bit about our guests. Sandra Amott is the editor of Nature Neuroscience. Before taking that post, she did her graduate work at the University of Rochester and was a postdoctoral researcher in neuroscience at Yale. Sam Wong is an associate professor of neuroscience and molecular biology at Princeton University. He's studied at Caltech, Stanford, Duke, and Bell Labs. He's the author of many articles on the brain that have been published in scientific journals and is the recipient of numerous awards for his work. Their book, Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life, is published by Bloomsbury. There's more information about our guests and the book at the website www.welcometoyourbrain.com. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, to the two of you, thanks you so much for joining us this afternoon. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having us.
You're very welcome. The things we think we know about the brain, where do these myths come from?
So that's an interesting question that we did look into somewhat when we were writing the book. For instance, the myth that you only use 10% of your brain has been around since the early 1900s, and it's all over the world. Half the people who were surveyed in Brazil believe this myth. But nobody really knows where it came from. Dale Carnegie, who propagated it very strongly in the introduction to his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, attributed it to a psychologist, William James, who, as far as anybody can tell, never actually said it.
It speaks, though, as you write about in the book, to our sense of optimism.
Well, one common thread to a lot of these myths is that there is this sense of wanting to improve yourself or looking for something within yourself that could be improved, could be made bigger or better. Mm. And can you hear me there?
Yes. Go ahead.
Celeste, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I am getting something funny in my headphones.
Okay. Well, why don't
you want me to pick up for a minute?
Yeah.
Straightened out?
Yeah, why don't we do that, Sandra?
Okay. Yeah, so that's also true of the myth that the Mozart effect, that playing classical music to your baby will make your baby smarter. That's one of the few brain myths that we can actually trace back to a source. That came from an article that was published in the scientific journal Nature about 15 years ago. And the article was a study that was done on college students and found an effect of classical music on IQ that lasted about 15 minutes. And somehow sociologists have traced this through journalism over the years and showed how that gradually changed from college students to children to babies, and how it changed from an effect that lasted for 15 minutes to a permanent lifelong musical enhancement.
Yeah, and back to what Sam was saying a moment ago about this myth about how much of our brain we're using. It speaks to this wanting to improve ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Is that hardwired? Is that something that's going on in the brain?
I think it may well be. Humans are distinct from other animals largely in terms of our ability to plan our behavior far out into the future. There's some academic debate about whether other animals can do this and to what extent, but I don't think it would be controversial to anybody to say that humans do more of it than any other species on the planet. And one of the things that naturally comes up when you try to plan your behavior out into the future and meet goals is the desire to have some of those goals be improving yourself.
Mm. And let's see if we have Sam Wong now with us from Princeton there. Sam, can you hear us? No, unfortunately not.
Mm.
Well, we will sally forth.
Okay.
With Sandra. This next question is inspired by the blog on your website, speaking of myths. What is source amnesia, and why are we susceptible to it?
So source amnesia is the fact that as a memory gets older, we tend to forget exactly where we heard it. So if this afternoon you read something in the National Enquirer and you read something else in the New York Times, you would probably assign a higher credibility to the piece of information that you got from the New York Times. But if I asked you 6 months from now, the odds are you wouldn't remember which place you heard which piece, and you would assign roughly equal credibility somewhere in the middle to both of them.
Yeah. Are there tactics we could employ to avoid source amnesia?
So the best way to remember things, the way that our brains naturally remember things, is in context. So the more context you can create around a memory, the better your chances of retaining it and of retaining those details of it. So if you really, if it's important for you to remember where you know something from and how credible it is, the best way to do that is by telling yourself a full... I can. Are you trying to get to Sam?
Yeah, we are. We're working on it. Unfortunate, but these things happen, causing a little anxiety here and there, which is appropriate, I suppose, given the circumstances. We're going to see if we've got Sam now again. Let's go back to Princeton and see if they've got us or if we've got them. Sam? No. Okay. You know what we could do, Sandra?
Mm-hmm.
We could get both of you on the phone, but in order to do that, we'll need to disconnect, and then we'll get both of you on telephones, and then we'll be in good shape. How about that?
Okay.
Okay. So stand by. We'll disconnect, and then we'll get the two of you back together, and both of you will be on the telephone. So, listeners, stand by. We're going to take a moment here and reconnect with our guests, Sandra Amott and Sam Wong, authors of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys, But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. Thank you. Okay, let's keep our fingers crossed here. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guests this afternoon are two neuroscientists, Sam Wong and Sandra Amit. They are the co-authors of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. We look forward to your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, fingers are crossed now. Sam, do we have you?
I am here.
Oh, it's so good to hear you.
It's lovely to hear from you, too.
And Sandra, are you there? Let's see. Hold on. Okay. We're getting the thumbs up here. Okay. Sandra?
Yep.
Hi.
Good.
All good.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
How far did we get?
So we just got through the Mozart myth and the 10% myth, and we were working on source amnesia when we decided to hang up and move along.
Yeah, and we're talking about, you know, also laying down memories. I think that's also interesting because in the book you say there's good evidence that we erase and rewrite our memories every time we recall them.
Yes, that's right. There seems to be, there's good evidence that what happens during recall of memory is not just playing back like a tape. So this metaphor that we have in our heads about, you know, our memories being like computer memories is not quite right. It's more like the act of recalling does something to reinforce the memory. And as a result, that can lead to things like your memory of an event changing slowly over time. So this can help explain why two people can remember an event very differently from one another.
Yeah. We've got a listener who would like to talk with us now, a caller in Muhammad on line 2. Good afternoon. Jason, you want to put the caller on, please? Thanks. We're having a run of bad luck here today.
You're
on
doing
the program.
A cross-country show, though. You've got me in Princeton and Sandra in California.
Okay, very good. Let's go to Muhammad now here in central Illinois. Line 2, good afternoon.
Hi. I am interested in what you think about the computer programs that train the brain instead of, for example, thinking, as you were talking about the same thing over and over to kind of stimulate the brain to reroute different areas.
Oh, well, that's a great question. Sandra, should we...
Now, why don't you start? I got to talk a lot in the beginning.
Okay, good. This is a really great question. We're glad that you asked about it. There's been a big craze for games and computer puzzles and the like that can help keep your brain young. And examples include Brain Age and doing Sudoku. And people really like these because they speak to this. We were talking about myths earlier in the hour about how you can, you know, improve yourself through these brain myths. These puzzles are pretty good at exercising the thing that you are doing during the puzzle. So, for instance, if you do Sudoku, which involves things like spatial reasoning, you get better at Sudoku puzzles, and you might get better at other things that are like Sudoku. But what they don't do is keep your brain young generally. And so that's a belief that people have, which is too bad. But there are other things that you can do to keep your brain young. And I assume, is that the reason you were interested in these puzzles, the keeping
you? No, we're a little bit off on the wrong start here.
Okay, well, go ahead.
I was thinking about the training programs, reading training programs for children that don't read well or that have shown to be good for some children that have autistic behavior, and it improves their social skills. So I was just wondering where you were with that, what all was myth and reality on that.
That's interesting. I don't know about the exact program that you're describing. I am very interested in autism, both in my research in my laboratory and also by virtue of the fact that my sister is autistic. Where those programs are at is that when autism is diagnosed early, there is behavioral therapy and training that can help autistic people cope a little bit better in the worlds around them. And it can alleviate some of the worst aspects of autism. It's not a cure. There's no cure for autism. But those programs are thought to help a little bit. Was there a particular thing that you wanted to know about those programs?
Well, one of the reasons they say that they work is that they're able to stimulate the brain in other areas and begin to get that area activated.
Oh, dear. Sandra, you want to jump in here?
Okay, yeah. So there are some academic researchers working on these kinds of interventions, particularly for dyslexia.
Right.
And what I would say about them is that some of them have been shown to work, but some of the ones that are most heavily marketed are not, do not come from scientists and have not really been adequately tested. And the way that you can tell when you're looking at the advertisements, the way you can distinguish those two, is that the programs that haven't been scientifically tested will have on their websites all these individual stories of, you know, my child used this program and now he's reading at grade level, and they won't have scientific references for studies that have been done.
Okay.
So that would be the basic guideline that I would suggest, that anybody who's selling a program based purely on success stories, you have to worry about placebo effects.
Yes. Okay.
A key phrase to look for is peer-reviewed studies.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Next, we go to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Actually, it'd be interesting to have Sam answer the he was answering the question, you know, in terms of what activities should we do.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds great. So
okay.
I'll let you.
So even though it was for the wrong question, you still like the answer.
Yeah, it's still a good question,
okay.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I'm asking it now so you can.
Right. Okay.
You know.
So people do worry about loss of brain function, and for instance, that one of the first things to peak and then start declining is memory, and then later in life you start losing other things like ability to plan ahead, self-control, and people are really interested in these puzzles because they think they help. The puzzles are generally helpful in training the same task to which the puzzle is designed, so that Sudoku makes you a little bit better at Sudoku and other puzzles that are like Sudoku. The thing that can really help with brain function as people get older, especially into their 70s and 80s, is physical exercise. And physical exercise, like fitness training, getting your heart rate up, getting on the treadmill, appears to have effects on cognitive function that are several times larger than any effect from these brain exercise puzzles. And so it's a little bit surprising, but roughly speaking, the reason is not exactly known, but it's probably that things that are good for your heart are good for blood circulation and oxygen supply to the brain as well. And so that basically, that's one major way that you can keep your brain strong as you get older.
Yeah. Another thing people are worried about as they get older is falling. And there's something going on in the brain that our balance is getting a little bit out of whack.
It's not clear whether that is, you know, to what extent that's problems with muscles and to what extent it's problems with the receptors in the inner ear versus the actual brain processing. But whatever it is reasonably well established that practicing types of exercise that require you to balance does help to preserve your sense of balance as you get older.
It's a general rule that well-practiced skills, not just balance and motor skills, but also cognitive skills, are retained better if they're well-practiced and if you're very familiar with them. There's something about that that helps you keep those skills.
Okay. So before you go out dancing, do a puzzle. Right?
I don't know if that would help. I think.
Well, I guess the idea is, what I'm picking up on anyway, is you want to work everything.
Yes, the other way to keep cognitive function as you get older is to keep what's called an intellectually engaged lifestyle. And that can mean learning a language. If you do intellectual work for a living, if you're a writer or what have you, there are a lot of things that people do in their professions that keep their minds going. And that's an important thing for retaining function later in life.
So read your book, Welcome to Your Brain. Do a puzzle and go dancing.
That's right.
Do it all.
Play bridge.
Play bridge, yeah. That's a great idea, too. You were going to say something else?
On the treadmill.
On the treadmill. Very good. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking today about the human brain. Our guests are Sandra Amott and Sam Wong, authors of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. What role do our senses play in making what the interpretation of what's going on around us. What role do our senses play in making our brain interpret what's happening?
So one of the things that's really surprising to people when they learn about neuroscience research is to find out how much of their what their brain does they're not aware of, and how difficult and complicated those things are. So if you've ever been driving down a dark road and seen a rock suddenly turn into a cat, you know that your sensory information is not always adequate to tell you exactly what's out there in the world. What you probably don't realize is how ambiguous your sensory information is just in regular low light. If you were a computer vision program, say, trying to figure out the visual world, you would see things change color in different lighting. They change shape depending on the angle you're looking at them from. None of these things seem very important to us because the brain recognizes those things and compensates for them before anything ever comes to your attention.
Hmm. Maybe you would tell us, Sam, the story of the blind skier.
Oh, that's a good story. So a good friend of ours, Mike May, lost his vision at an early age, but had vision as a small child, and spent most of his life without vision, and then had his vision restored by an operation. And what he found was that he had a lot of difficulty coping. One day he was on the ski slopes, and he's headed towards this large, dark object, and he's coming closer and closer, and he was convinced that he was going to die. He was going downhill. And then he went right through it. It turned out to be a shadow. And it emerged that he was unable to process shadow information because he had difficulty seeing that the object in front of him was not an object, but a shadow. So it's connected with what Sandra has talked about with us doing a lot of interpretation of what we see.
Hmm. Let's take some more calls now. Next we go to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have a question that comes from my experience with my mother when she was up in years. She's passed away now. But she had been in a car accident and had hit her head pretty severely, probably 3 years before she died. But one of the things that she was dealing with was a kind of like a fixation on a thought. She said she would think the same thought over and over again thousands of times, and she couldn't get out of that kind of loop. And I've always wondered whether that is kind of a normal thing that happens with people as they get elderly, or whether it might have been something caused by the blow to the head in the car accident.
Sounds to me like that would be more likely to have been something from the car accident. That's not a typical symptom of aging.
Ah, that's reassuring. Okay, thank you.
Next we go to a listener in Champaign on line two. Good afternoon.
Thank you. I'd like to go back in part to the issue about memory and your statement about memories being erased and rewritten, but also in somewhat in context of, I don't remember if it was Afternoon Magazine or the morning show, the Focus 580, there were authors of about body maps of the brain on a while back and how the brain not only maps both what you feel and touch and that kind of stuff, but also your internal organs, but also the scientific evidence for it mapping, you know, the space around you as well, that you're not, you know, not physically you. And I'm just wondering, you know, how that might relate to people's ability to sense things without touching or seeing or smelling them. That sort of thing, and if there's anything in what you've studied that goes along with that.
Well, the brain is filled with maps. So, for instance, the visual world that projects onto the retinas in your eyes gets sent to a part of your brain called the visual cortex, and it's a map in which something happening in a particular part of the world that you can see activates a little bit of brain tissue that corresponds to that bit of the world. And your body surface has a map. And we even have maps of places that we navigate. So, for instance, you can study this both in people, also in rats, that as they explore a space, there's some mapping of the space into their brain. And in particular, this uses the hippocampus. And so the brain is filled with these maps that help us get through the world. If I understand your question correctly, I think the answer to your question is that these maps are set up by sensory information, and they help us keep track of sensory inputs that come in. And once we establish them, they help us navigate the space as we go through it again. So I think, are you asking about something other than sensory-driven experience?
Well, I guess in part I'm sort of wondering where the boundaries of sensory information are. And I was also interested in the issue about memories and how they're formed and retrieved, because I've heard some people talk about the brain is sort of a receiver that maybe, you know, our memories aren't actually stored in our brains, but they're out there in the ether or whatever, and that we just retrieve them from time to time, and that's how we can also tap into other things. But in martial arts, there's also a saying of, you know, if you meditate a lot and become extremely sensitive, the saying is, you know, your opponent moves, you move first. In other words, somehow you're able to gain an awareness of what they're going to do before, you know, they're actually, you know, as soon as it comes into their intention to do it, before they've been able to do it,
right,
you know they're doing it.
Well, as a working neuroscientist, and we're both neuroscientists, I think our view about where mental phenomena come from is the same view as, for instance, if you're studying a bouncing ball, you look at the ball, and our view is that all mental phenomena come from the brain, and that activity within the brain is what happens, is the source of storing information and recalling it, and that all these things you're talking about are physical things that are within the brain. And this is something that's been the subject of decades of study that's really accelerated in the last few decades. And so now, to partly speak to what you're talking about, there are certainly aspects of experience that we do not have conscious access to, and people have even been able to study that. So, for instance, you can study, say, a card game that is stacked against you, and you can start acting on the fact that the deck is stacked without being consciously aware that something's going on. And so there are levels of experience that we are unable to describe but are still happening within our brains. And so I think that would generally be the point of view of neuroscientists. And as far as tapping something in the ether, yeah, that would be something that would not be scientific.
So to come back to this question of your martial arts example, though, there is some evidence that people who are untrained often show brain activity and start initiating movements before they become aware that they're doing it. And I can easily imagine that somebody who was highly trained might get that awareness that they were initiating a movement earlier, and that might be the source of the experience that you're talking about, of feeling like you know that your opponent's going to move and you're reacting before they've even started.
Does the listener want to come back?
Well, I was also interested in going back to this issue about what memories are and how they're retrieved, you know, and certainly, I think, you know, we've all had the experience of thinking we remember how something is, and then somehow we'll find out that actually it was different than we remember it. But, yeah, I mean, you know, I was curious about the statement you said that memories being erased and rewritten every time you retrieve them, and what that was about.
Yeah, there's both neural and behavioral evidence for that people, for instance, the behavioral studies have done things like asking people immediately after some major tragedy that's in the news, like 9/11 or the space shuttle disaster, where were you and what were you doing, and then coming back and asking them a year later, so where were you and what were you doing, you get very different answers. And that is on a neural basis, because every time you recall a memory, you have to store it again. And sometimes the context in which you recall it and the stories that you tell yourself while you're recalling it will presumably change the way that it gets restored and actually change the memory.
Hmm. And the book that the listener was referring to is The Body Has a Mind of Its Own, How Body Maps in Your Brain Help You Do Almost Everything Better. And it is written by a mother and son who happen to both be science writers. And it was here on the Afternoon Magazine, so if people are interested, they could access that interview through our archives.
The last name is Blakesley.
Blakesley, yes.
Yeah, Sandra and Michael Blakesley, mm-hmm. Matthew Blakesley.
Yeah, it's an interesting book. Well, let's go on and take another call, another listener in Champaign, Line 3. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. I tuned in late, so perhaps you've answered this. I know there are ways of recalling names of new people that you meet, but what's kind of scary is forgetting names of people that you've known for a long time, and then suddenly the name disappears, and it may come back 5 minutes later or a day later, and I was wondering what causes that.
Well, it happens to me, if that makes you feel any better. We did touch upon this a little bit earlier, that our memory capacities increase in our 20s and peak around 30, and so it's natural to experience some degree of memory loss after the age of 30, and that can include things like remembering a phone number that you were trying to hold in your head long enough to dial it, and it can also involve things like that. There, memory declines are normal. Severe memory declines to the point of forgetting basic life facts like whether you wear glasses. The rule of thumb, one way of thinking of it is, if you forget where you put your glasses, that's normal memory loss. If you forget the fact that you wear glasses, that's more serious. And so some mild kinds of memory loss can be practiced, and basically training can help you with these things. But, you know, what you're describing sounds within the normal range of memory loss.
Okay, thank you. But it's surprising that people that you've known and then suddenly forget and then comes back to you.
Yes.
Later.
Yes, it is odd. Memory is not is not addressable that way.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome. Next, we take a call from Arthur, Illinois, line one. Hi.
Well, hello. I wanted to talk a little bit about the DOOR program in the book written by Winfred Doerr, and I wondered if you were familiar with that.
Yeah, I wrote an editorial about that in my journal a few years ago. And
do you feel that there is the chance that this physical type of therapy would help connect portions of the brain and make them work better?
That is one of the programs that I was thinking about when I said earlier that many of these programs are not designed by scientists and are sold largely on the basis of
anecdote
without scientific testing.
Okay, and that was one of the ones that specifically came to my mind. I've seen their advertising, and I wondered what you thought.
Their advertising matches the description that I gave.
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm.
Testimonials without proof.
Okay. Well, that was just what I wanted to ask. Thank you very much for your input.
You're welcome. Let's take another call. A listener in Tuscola, line four. Hi.
Hello. My husband and I have an ongoing discussion about my lack of sense of direction or geographical memory. For example, if he's driven someplace once, he remembers it years later and can still get around in that city, whereas I'm always lost, and he doesn't seem to understand that I don't remember places or, you know, geography. So I guess my question, I tell him I don't have a geographical memory, and he thinks it's just an excuse for not paying attention. But I guess my question is, do some people process where they've been and retain it, whereas somebody like me doesn't?
That is a very well-known sex difference, actually.
Really?
Women, and this is not just a cultural difference because it happens also in rats.
Huh.
So it's not the way you were raised or anything. It's that women tend to process directions in terms of landmarks, and that, you know, it's not 100%. It's not every woman, but more women tend to process direction in terms of landmarks,
uh-huh.
And men tend to process direction in terms of the absolute north, south, east, west cognitive mapping. And I have the same problem in spades, I can assure you. Perfectly normal.
Well, I think that makes me feel better. I somehow think that I should be able to recall and remember just as well as he can, but it's like it just evaporates.
One thing that's often observed is that women tend to recall the spatial locations of objects better. And so if you're looking for if you and he are looking for some object like where is the ruler or where is the mustard in the refrigerator,
right.
On average, women are better at remembering that kind of spatial information than the directional type.
Which may be because that's commonly coded in terms of landmarks. The mustard is just back there to the left of the mayonnaise.
Right. Well, I don't think I'll worry about it anymore then. Stop the argument. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. What a great question.
That is a good question.
Years ago, I hadn't been in my hometown for quite some time, and my husband was, we were in the car together, and he asked me for directions, and I said, you know what? Let's switch places. I can drive it, but I can't tell you it.
And yeah, because it looked right.
Yeah. It's like, here it is. Here's where we turn.
That's landmarks.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, two neuroscientists, Sandra Amott and Sam Wong. They are the authors of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive, and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. Listeners, if you've got a question, a comment, join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. In the book, you tell readers how to use their brains to improve their ability to hear better on cell phones in noisy places. The trick is not to put a finger in your open ear, but to cover the mouthpiece. Why is that?
Well, it's a great trick. I should just say that if people are out there trying to get use their cell phones, they will find that this often helps. So it's a natural impulse to put your finger in your other ear. But what happens is that phones use this this trick that engineers call full duplex, and that's a fancy term for taking the signal in your voice and the room around you and feeding it through the mouthpiece and putting it into the earpiece. And this is meant to give you a more natural feeling for the conversation because it makes you feel like the person's there. But what it does is it creates a situation that's very hard for your brain to interpret, so that what your brain has to contend with is room noise in one ear and then room noise combined with your friend's voice in the other ear, and there's a tendency for the room noise to dominate. So if you put your finger over the mouthpiece, what you now have done is create a situation where the room noise is in one ear, your friend's voice is in the other ear, and your brain is very good at this source separation problem where there's different signals coming in to the two ears. And so by putting your finger over the mouthpiece, you create a situation that your brain is very well equipped to handle. The voice isn't any louder, but your brain can handle it better.
Speaking of cell phones, there are concerns about cell phones in automobiles and people driving while talking on the cell phone. Does it differ? Is that interaction different than if someone is sitting side by side with you in an automobile and you're talking with them, or if you're listening, say, to this program in the car on the radio?
It probably does. In studies, it has been shown that cell phone use distracts people from obvious signals, like can make them miss stop signs and other kinds of things that you would really want to pay attention to as a driver. Probably that's because you're more actively engaged in a cell phone conversation, so it's taking up more of the conscious part of your brain. And unless you're sitting there yelling at the radio, no, no, that's not right.
Someone might be doing that today.
I hope not.
No, probably not.
I don't think so.
One thing about the cell phone use, though, is that even hands-free cell phones have also been shown to be associated with a higher accident rate. So it's not the physical handling of the phone. There's something about active conversation that increases risk.
Yeah. Let's take another call, a listener in Savoy. Line one, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to address something that was said at the very beginning in the little quiz about alcohol not affecting or killing brain cells. And in several different things I've read, including a book I have by an MD called Brain Longevity, he says that small amounts of alcohol can kill brain cells. And I read that also in a medical publication, which was actually laying on a table at Christie Clinic a while back. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, what the real deal is on that. Does it or does it not kill brain cells? And if so, how did that get out there, that alcohol does kill brain cells, even small amounts of it?
Well, what has been observed, that's a good question. What has been observed is that heavy drinking for many years does lead to brain shrinkage, but that's only really been observed after really quite a lot of drinking and for many years. And the second thing that's been observed is that amount of shrinkage can reverse after people stop drinking. But what's been done is people have looked carefully by counting the brain cells in the brains of people who are heavy drinkers, and the number of cells doesn't change. And so what appears to be the case is that what happens is that the individual cells shrink somewhat, and so each one perhaps has smaller of these objects called dendrites, which are the tree-like structures that you use to gather information. So it's probably not true that drinking heavy amounts, even heavy amounts, causes a loss of brain cells. But there can be loss of brain function with heavy drinking. And what's been observed is that a safe amount of alcohol, in terms of not causing cognitive decline or brain damage, is up to about 3 drinks a day for men and 2 for women. And less than that has not been associated with loss of cognitive function.
Well, that's very interesting to know, and thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Champaign. Hi. Line 2.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I have been studying various aspects of comprehension, the three-dimensional, fourth-dimensional space-time continuum, and I've encountered some people that seem to have the capacity to understand various things that the average person is totally unaware. Like most people live in a two-dimensional world, and only a few are aware of three dimensions. And when somebody starts talking about the space-time continuum, or the astronaut program, they can get into the fourth-dimensional reality of causal effects.
Well, that's...
Have you done any research on the ESP or fourth-dimensional reality awareness?
Sam said earlier, our position on that is that the physical reality is what we're stuck with. Now, there are people who can do some pretty amazing things, who can control aspects of their brains that most of us can't control. For instance, we saw a video not too long ago of a Buddhist monk who does this meditation practice where he controls his body temperature, and he can sit surrounded by ice for an entire hour without getting frostbite. There is a straightforward physical explanation for that, which is that he's gotten conscious control of these circuits in your brain that normally control body temperature. So there are amazing things that people can do with their brains, but our belief is that those all have some physical explanation.
Let's see if we can get one more call in. Listener in Darlington, Indiana. Line 4, hi.
Hello, great program. Real quick question, obsessive-compulsive disorder, how that relates to brain functions. If your guest would speak on that, be greatly interested. I'll hang up and listen offline. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for the question.
So obsessive-compulsive disorder is clearly a disease of brain function. It's actual brain basis is not very well understood, but we do know that it responds to a lot of the same drugs that are used to treat depression.
Okay.
Right. So, for instance, antidepressants, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, these have been, in some cases, found to help.
Yeah. What about psychotherapy in terms of talk therapy?
There are certain kinds of talk therapy that I think are somewhat effective for obsessive-compulsive disorder, but it's really a physical disease, and there are you have to be have somebody who's really specialized in doing that kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, in the case of depression, different treatments seem to work with different people. So there are some people for whom cognitive behavioral therapy does help somewhat with their depression, but that would be, you know, one thing you try, and then another thing you try is medication. And a typical approach is to try one and see if it works, and then try another one. But these do have to be in the hands of a good practitioner.
And in fact, they sometimes work well together also. Sometimes you can get a better effect from both together than you can from each one separately.
Hmm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. It was a rocky start, but it was a good finish, right? So I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us this afternoon, and thanks also to all the great questions we got from listeners this afternoon. Our guests today have been Sam Wong and Sandra Amott. They are the authors of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. The book is published by Bloomsbury, and there is more information about the book and our guests at the website www.welcometoyourbrain.com. Thanks, Sandra. Thanks, Sam. And thanks also to Liz Patton at Princeton, where Sam joined us from this afternoon.
Our pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.